All right. Let's jump into what we are here to do, my friend. The 3-2-1, welcome back to Decouple, Noah Rettberg. Everyone knows who you are, although it's been a long time since you've been with us. Noah, the reason I've brought you back, well, I have lots of things I'd like to talk to you about, so it's hard to narrow it down, but, you know, I was over in Dubai. There was a great talk by Stefan Kvist, and I'm blanking on his co-presenter, but they were talking a lot about, you know, decarbonization, difficult to abate sectors, and nuclear, one of the selling points that advocates will point to is that it does more than just electricity. It can provide heat, which is something that you know, other low carbon options struggle with. So I wanted to explore that today. We're going to call this episode Prospects for Process Heat. And I guess this is sort of by necessity going to be a talk that's far ranging and looking at a few different reactor designs and what the prospects are for them coming through in this tricky area of decarbonization. So Noah, again, welcome back to the pod. It's been too long.
It's nice to be here again. You had to get along without me. Don't know how that went. but I'm glad to be here again. It's certainly I always like our chats. So
wonderful. Yes, our Germany coverage has lapsed. You are our German correspondent. We'll talk about that another time. How do you want to tackle it?
Well, at some point that's boring to me to be like, yeah, it got worse again, and so.
Okay, well let's jump into the matter at hand, prospects for process heat, and talk about some nuclear process heat applications. You know, I guess part of this is, you know, if this is such a exciting possibility, why is it not happening, or why has it not happened? But I might be unaware. Maybe it has happened. So let's maybe dive in historically, but I'll let you pick sort of our starting point.
So let's start with what process heat is, and let's make one clear distinction, because where we use heat, where we use thermal energy in our world, in most cases we use the heat to drive a heat engine and generate work for mobile applications. For stationary applications, work generation is done by electricity in our times. In the past, it used to be also done with thermal heat. And also for like room heating for buildings, because if the building is cold, this makes us uncomfortable and sick. And also just when a building is not constantly heated at the time, the thermal expansion and contraction as the building heats up and cools down cyclically can damage a building. So, but process heat is distinct from that. Process heat is the heat that we use to drive production processes. And when we talk about these production processes, we usually talk about heat that we use to modify, that we use to work on something which we modify thermally. This could be more home cooking, or industrial cooking, when we made food or when we bake bread. These are process heat applications where we like use the heat to drive chemical reactions like the Maillard reaction, browning, caramelizing flavors and such, but also just to evaporate steam, to evaporate water, to cook our food. And also process heat is used in metalworking. Processes like casting or forging come easily to mind when we talk about this. But what should not be ignored is also annealing and hardening. So where we use heat application to a workpiece, not to make it malleable, but to rearrange its crystalline structure to make it more or less hard in order to make a hard tool or make an annealed metal that can bend into the shape we need. So, but also in chemical industry, in the oil and gas sector, generally to use heat to evaporate or melt stuff, especially for the purpose of separating, be that separating water, ethanol out of water, if we want to make spirits, or be that separating gasoline out of raw oil, if we want to make fuels. These are thermal processes. similarly, when we want to dry out stuff, we use process heat. When we have, for example, in the paper making industry, we use process heat to dry out the paper pulp to make solid sheets of paper or cardboard. And in one other aspect is also to use process heat to drive chemical reactions. When we, for example, make concrete or when we prepare metal ore, we deal with carbonate salts, essentially. With concrete, it's calcium carbonate, and which needs to be turned into calcium oxide to make cement, be that Portland or Portland cement or simple mortar. We first need to drive the process of putting the carbon dioxide out of a carbonate salt. And this is an endothermic reaction, so we need to put a lot of heat into it to make the result. Also, when we have like iron ore, of these are often carbonate salts, so we need to roast the iron ore and to break down the carbonate salts in there so we can separate our ore. So there, basically, when we look at it, the process heat can be used for like evaporation of liquid, for changing the material structure of a workpiece directly to a liquid phase, if we talk about melting, or just making it more malleable, or just rearranging the crystalline structure in hardening or annealing, or to drive endothermic chemical reactions. So our process heat applications essentially boil down to these processes.
No, that's that's okay. That's a very, you've enriched my understanding already remarkably. We hear about different temperatures that are required to do these different processes you mentioned, and I love just tying it into it's something we do so mundanely every single day, cooking our food, for instance. But we hear that is a potential limitation right now. I think conventional water-cooled, water-moderated plants, nuclear plants produce waste heat or process heat that's insufficient to do a lot of these reactions. Can you talk about the different grades of heat required to do each of these things and, how high we can go conceptually with some of the nuclear designs being considered?
So generally, one thing that we need to get familiar with when we talk about process heat application is that we need to get our heat from where it is generated into where we want it. This can be very as simple as putting like a piece of iron or steel that we want to forge directly into the burning coal. So there the heat transfer is very simple and very obvious to us. Or just if we cook at home, the heat transfer from our stove, be it gas or electric, into our food is also clearly understandable to us through either conductivity or through just the gases released in the combustion directly heating our workpiece. But in many cases in industry, the heat transfer process is very complex. And in many of these complex cases, it is done usually with thermal oils or with steam. And but there are limits to where we can use steam or thermal oils as a heat transfer system. So I talked about limits after that. So where we are limited with our steam, where the steam cannot reach us, we either heat directly with the heat released from our combustion gases. So in most metalworking processes, you use the combustion gases to heat either your metal directly or to heat like the vessel in which your metal is contained. Like if you have a ceramic, pot where you have your molten metal and you heat that with the combustion gases. But even this, if you are talking about metals which need to get really hot, well exceeding 1,000, approaching the 2,000 degrees Celsius range, you can also not reach this with the conventional conduction by exhaust gases or your vessel anymore. So in this range, you either need electric arcs generating plasma, which can exceed the 3,000 degrees Celsius range, or what you would need is inductive heating, which only works with conductive things, so basically just metal. And with inductive heating, you apply an oscillating magnetic field at the outside of your metal, and then eddy currents will form inside, will be generated by the oscillating magnetic field inside metal and heat the metal from inside. So this also inductive heating is used for hardening processes. At work, in the workshop where I work, I have lathes which, for example, have inductively hardened bedways. So where just in, the eddy currents are used to heat up the cast iron, and then the cast iron is trenched and the crystalline structure makes the cast iron heat. So inductive heating, is not just something that is very useful when you cook food. It is essential for many modern process heat applications because you can't just it can reach temperatures that exhaust gases could not reach. And it is in many cases much more easily applicable. You can, for example, directly heat just the top of the bed waves of my lathe rather than just heating up the entire bed wave. So you can use it also to apply heat precisely. You can use it to apply heat in very hot temperatures. And you can also, if you want to reach very hot temperatures, you can also use electric arc furnaces, which are essentially unlimited in where they go. But we use them for applications in industry where we go beyond the 2,000 degrees Celsius range, or also for melting down steel.
So it sounds like, you know, any sort of power source that can generate electricity is capable of electric arc. And I'm not sure if induction is an electrically driven process. So what are, like, if we're trying to eliminate carbon-based fuels out of the equation, what are the areas that are sort of most difficult, the temperature ranges that are most difficult to get into, not just in terms of getting to that temperature, but in terms of volume of processes that need to run? Again, I've heard, you know, nuclear can be excellent for things like district heating. Again, that is not process heating. But in terms of the vast majority of the world's processes that require heat, what's the, not the lowest hanging fruit, but the largest areas that need to be addressed if we were to stop using, again, carbon-based fuels for process heat?
So process heat consumption makes up around a third of our energy consumption. It depends on the country. Here in Germany, it's a bit less than a third, but roughly a third.
And even lower
half
now, right?
Of the process, the figures that I know are a bit dated, so could be. And of that, of the process heat, around half sits at temperatures below 500 degrees Celsius. And these are the temperatures where usually steam is used as the heat transfer fluid. Using steam as a heat transfer fluid beyond these 500 degrees is not very practical. Modern steam generators struggle with getting steam much hotter than 650 degrees Celsius. So even in the most modern coal plant, you usually don't have steam generators which go beyond these temperatures. It just at these temperatures and the high pressures of the steam, just the heating pipes in the steam generators are stretched, put to their limit, and are not as robust as at lower temperatures. So you can't really get beyond that. And so the steam can only be generated to temperatures of around 650 degrees Celsius. So this limits you to a point. And then you have to consider that what you are heating with your steam is of a lower temperature than your steam. And so above the 500 degrees Celsius range, steam is no longer really useful as a heat transfer fluid. And this is like half of the process heat applications, which are essentially never going to be reached by nuclear energy. Because while you can make a nuclear reactor where you have the coolant, which is hotter than 650 degrees Celsius, you can't just pipe the coolant directly from the reactor to where your process heat is used. When you do that, you essentially make you require your entire industrial plant to be monitored for radiation, which is essentially a big reason why many utilities don't want to use boiling water reactors. Is in the boiling water reactors, the primary circuit runs through the turbine, so the turbine has to be monitored for radiation, and you have to treat the turbine building similarly to how you treat the reactor building. And the pressurized water reactor it can just be its own thing. It doesn't need the intensive radiation protection and monitoring. And similarly, for an industrial plant, you would not want to run the reactor coolant directly into your industrial plant. You would want a second medium to bridge to pass the energy on, the heat on, before you you make the heat leave your nuclear island. And you would do this usually with steam. And there are, and the steam is limited to 650 degrees Celsius. So we could simply say, I would say that half of all process heat applications will never be reached with nuclear, ever, unless you lose electricity to for your heat.
How energy intensive are electric arc furnaces? How do they compare, say, to in steel production? How would that compare to just using traditional methods?
I've read an old paper, it's from the 80s, German paper, which comes to the conclusion that using an electric arc furnace to remelt scrap steel is about 40% more efficient than using coal directly to melt down the steel, because the electric arc furnaces can apply their heat that they generate much more directly into the material compared to the traditional coal-fired method. But keep in mind, the study from the time used state-of-the-art 80s-era coal power plants and compared it to how the coal power plants running the electric arc furnaces to a state-of-the-art conventional coal-fired steel making. So the electric arc furnaces are very efficient, and they have an economic case. There's an economic case to run electric arc furnaces to melt down steel, even in a world where both your plant, in a world where both your electric arc furnace and your conventional melting would be powered entirely by coal. So, I think one should kind of lose the understanding that using electricity to power process heat is inherently inefficient. Because in many cases, using combustion to power these processes also brings with it itself certain inefficiencies. It can apply the heat much more indirectly. It cannot. You have transfer losses there, and you also you use a much more complicated process to heat up what you want to heat up. Many electric applications, like induction or resistive or electric arc furnaces, can put their heat much more directly onto where you want it. And they can also can use a much less complex system, because you can put the electric heater where it needs to be. You can put the induction coil where it needs to be. You can, for example, with my lathe, you can just put the induction coils above the bed ways directly, and you do not need to heat up the entire body of the lathe. So one should not underestimate the efficiencies of the electric process.
So I mean, there's a difference between energy analysis of efficiencies and obviously economic efficiencies. This is a criticism I hear a lot, a criticism of Václav Smil's work, or people talking about primary energy. A lot of folks, particularly on the alt energy, I'm forgetting the exact term that people use now, right? But clean tech. They say, well, listen, it's actually not such a challenge to replace fossil fuels, because you're talking primary energy. Electric motors are much more efficient, for instance. So we only need to replace about one third of primary energy. But obviously, it's fairly easy to dig something under the ground and burn it, even if you are wasting 70% of that heat as waste heat, for instance. So how does that work? I mean, there's a reason why the majority of the world's steel mills are not electric. Obviously, it takes a lot of juice, I'm guessing, to run an electric arc furnace.
We have a global electricity shortage, as simple as that.
Okay.
Yeah. One major reason.
Expand on the kind of, the energy economics versus the, the monetary economics of electric arc furnaces.
The energy economics, so using a coal power plant, what I've read, though that is work from the late 80s done here in Germany, is that the arc furnaces are 40% more efficient. if we talk not just arc furnaces, but the economy in general, a friend of mine, Florian Blüm, which has a very fantastic blog, but most of your audience can't read him because it's in German. He basically did a calculation how much using these processes he would, how much energy you would need to decarbonize Germany with electricity only, in a manner that would not lead to any loss of living standard or any loss of industrial output in Germany. So essentially decarbonize the entire German economy as of, I think, he used 2019 as a baseline, without any loss of industry, without any loss of quality of life. And back then, Germany used around 3,500 terawatt hours of primary energy. I think 90%, around 90% of it was either fossil or nuclear. 6% was nuclear back then. And then he looked into which processes you would need to drive these. He said that for most automotive applications, you would use battery electric. For a few applications, you would use synthetic fuels made from hydrogen. You would also use synthetic fuels for, in his assumption, you would use synthetic fuels for some power peaking. And you would use for process heat almost entirely electric, directly electrically powered. And for home heating, you would use heat pumps backed up by synthetic fuels just for peak demand. And in his assumption, where he used electricity only for basically process heat, he got around 70% of the primary energy consumption that we do now have. So Germany would go down from 3,500 terawatt hours of primary energy consumption, and you would then get 2,500 terawatt hours of electricity consumption to decarbonize the entire German economy, with using 2019 as a baseline. And the methodology that he used, I tend to agree with. He excluded nuclear process heat from the use, and also excluded nuclear district heating. But if you would use just electricity only, then you would get to similar numbers. So for very industrialized modern economy that has not seen a lot of deindustrialization like other Western countries, Germany 2019, you can probably reduce your energy. You can have like 70% of your primary energy consumption, but just as electricity. So you get a little bit more efficiently, certainly, but many of the clean tech advocates drastically overestimate the efficiency gains that they can get with drawing electricity only, which comes from using basically electric vehicles as a comparative. They compare some a little bit unrealistic efficiencies of modern electric vehicles. They usually take 80%. It's more like 70% well-to-wheel. And they put that against outdated combustion engines, which are at around 20%. Modern combustion engines can go from 30%, well above 30%, up to 40% thermal efficiency. And from comparing these 80% efficiency to 20% efficiency, they get the idea that they can decarbonize the economy with just a third of the energy that we use now in electricity. You will overall probably end up more with around 70% of the energy that we use now, using the methodology of Mr. Blüm. And I tend to agree with Mr. Blüm, and I think either he should translate this article or I should do it, because it's very worth reading to understand the different decarbonization processes that you would use in an electricity-only scenario. And this can give you some efficiencies, but not as much as most people think.
So suffice it to say, you know, a lot of these process heat applications would benefit from a baseload generator because we're trying to run them efficiently around the clock. So, I mean, that's just kind of obvious. If you wanted to electrify process heat, probably would have been good to keep those nuclear plants running. I don't think we need to belabor that point. And I want to move into some of the technologies that are being discussed that may be more ideal to process heat. And in my simplistic understanding, that'd be things like high temperature gas reactors, sodium fast reactors. I don't know if they have to be fast, but sodium reactors and molten salt reactors. Am I missing anything? And can we maybe take a turn on each of these to try and understand their applications?
I would like to add lead cooled and reactors cooled with supercritical water.
Okay.
Which is, you Canadians especially did some very interesting research into water. Reactors can do cooled with supercritical water, where you would have supercritical water at temperatures exceeding 500 degrees inside your CANDU reactors. And according to what I've read, you even intended to use special zirconium alloys inside your reactor, which is very important because it's not like you can make water reactors, not like you can very much make water reactors hotter than we currently do. But you would usually, in order to do that, make the innards of the reactor, you would make them out of, many of that would be made of steel. Steel is absorbs much more neutrons. So if you would make the reactor hotter and you would make the reactor more of the fuel cladding out of steel, you would make the reactor more thermally efficient but less neutronically efficient. And this is why it has never been done, because there is no reason to go more thermally efficient. Fuel is plenty enough. And if the reactor is less neutronically efficient, you don't even gain anything from it. But there was research in Canada, I think, up until 2006 by Atomic Energy of Canada Limited into zirconium alloys, which can sustain these higher temperatures, and especially can sustain supercritical water, which is much more aggressive than either hot water or hot steam. And I'm not sure how much they got with this research. I know that it has been done. I would really love to see whether this can work. There hasn't been a lot of research into supercritically water-cooled reactors, where the supercritical refers to the water, not to the reactor. I want to amend that. But sadly, there has not been happening a lot in this field lately. But I think we should mention
that. I don't want to get lost into, I know because of your technical expertise, we could spend hours on each of these. So I want to make sure that we don't bite off more than we can chew in the kind of about around half an hour we have left. Maybe why don't we go through a few of these technologies anyway in what you consider to be the highest likelihood of success, or the best demonstrated track record, or essentially the most likely to fill this gap for, I guess, both high temperature steam, with that caveat that it's kind of limited for processes above 500-600 C. I guess we're focusing on that, right? Because any old power reactor can make electricity.
The first high temperature reactors which were built in any significant quality, not that there is really another type of high temperature reactors that has been built in significant quality, and these were the advanced gas reactors by the British. And usually when we say advanced reactor, we think of like some modern paper reactors, but these were reactors which were designed in the 60s and built in the 70s and 80s in Britain. So this is very much an established technology. That's also a technology where we can kind of see some of the promises by the hot temperature falling apart. The British wanted to build these advanced gas-cooled reactors as an improvement upon their earlier generation Magnox reactors, which were cooled with also with CO2, hot CO2, but couldn't generate steam significantly hotter than water-cooled reactors. And the advanced gas reactors were planned to generate steam exceeding the temperatures which coal power plants back in the 60s could reach, much more akin to the temperatures modern coal power plants can reach in the 600-degree range. And though I think the steam that they generate is more than 550, if I'm not wrong. But their reactor, the CO2 inside the reactor gets up to 750 degrees. So they generate superheated steam, and they therefore can run much more efficient turbines. there has been it has been looked into whether the using the advanced air cooled reactors might be interesting as a source of process heat in Britain for both industry and for generation of hydrogen. The hydrogen was never really put in fruition, and most of the British nuclear power plants are too far away from industry to really be useful for this purpose. So this has not has never been done. Also, there are other problems of the advanced gas-cooled reactors. Basically, almost all of them were over budget and over schedule. So you can say that this might be a fixable issue. There have been light water reactors which have been over budget and behind schedule as well. But unluckily, almost all of them were. They had never really great capacity factor, even as the technology matured.
Is there a reason why?
Essentially, they use steel cladding for their fuel elements. The fuel element, the burn up in the elements is not as great, so they need to change fuel elements much more often. They were tried, and in some of them they used online refueling, but in many of them this was not achieved. So they use a very time-consuming offline refueling. So they are offline for a lot of time for refueling and maintenance. Also, as they got older, there were material issues inside the power plants, and many of them had to be derated and now run on significantly reduced power. Whereas in almost all light water reactors, we have gotten power up rates. Some very crazy Swedish nuclear power plants, which has seen almost a third, 30% increase of power in up rates. The British had to derate their reactors. Also, these reactors, especially when you consider them over all of their lifetime, these have been costly to build. They will be costly to decommission. Also, the fuel handling and fuel disposal is much more costly than light water reactors. So you can generate process heat. With the AGR design, you can generate the very hot steam that you would need to fulfill the entire half of process heat demands that you can meet with very hot steam. But this steam would be much more costly than probably using electricity from a light water reactor directly. And these reactors are not as reliable as light water reactors are. So they will probably, and also the British completely gave up the design, so we will not see them in the future.
How do the AGRs compare to like X energy or a high temperature gas reactor? I think that's a German technology, the pebble bed or TRISO fuel. I'm out of my water here. Help me understand the difference.
I think TRISO fuel were actually also the Brits. The Brits had like a 4-tier master plan of mastering the gas-cooled reactor, including where the fourth tier were like gas-cooled fast reactors, and the second tier were the AGRs. And the third tier would have envisioned to be TRISO reactors, just as its energy tries to do. The TRISO reactors using helium as a coolant and the TRISO fuel. They had a demonstration reactor. They had the Dragon reactor, a demonstration reactor, which had no turbine, just the heat output, which they used to research TRISO fueled reactors. But they gave it up, especially when the AGRs became a much more troubled reactor. And then in the late 80s, they looked into building light water reactors instead. So with the Brits canceling their entire gas reactor program, so that the British TRISO reactor program, there has also been an American and a German endeavor into this. The American one used TRISO fuel in prismatic fuel elements at the nuclear power plant at Fort McWane.
What's a prismatic fuel element? Like, I'm understanding high temperature gas reactors, or at least maybe pebble bed is the wrong word. I guess the TRISO fuel is kind of like a bubble gum machine, and the gases are moving up through these balls essentially that are all, you know, lying together, and I guess they get shifted and moved in terms of not necessarily refueling, but just fuel management. which is very, very different from the AGR. I visited Hunterston B and that was an AGR, and they just had these insane fuel elements. The graphite core you were talking about was just massive. I mean, these are like 7-8 story buildings plus 3 stories for the refueling machine. So I'm trying to get a sense of how they differ physically as well. And just for our listeners that aren't aware of, you know, prismatic things.
So the prismatic fuel just means it's more like a traditional fuel element made up of rods.
Okay.
That's gotcha. The hexagonal shape. And then when you extend a polygonal surface, you get a prisma, so prismatic, just a general shape. So imagine it more like a traditional, very much like a traditional reactor. And the bubblegum design is the TRISO reactor design that came from Germany. It was realized in 2 reactors here in Germany. First, the AVR in the 60s, and then the THDR in the 80s. These were envisioned as to simplify the refueling processes, because refueling a non-water-cooled reactor is not trivial. In a water-cooled reactor, you can basically open the reactor entirely, stare down into the reactor, because you have water on top of it, and the water shields you. And you can then move the fuel element under the hot fuel element under the water. In a non-water-cooled reactor, you need to use much more complicated fuel handling systems, be that sodium or gas cooled or whatever. It's not as trivial. So in order to make the refueling much more easier, they envisioned a design where you would just load the cold nuclear fuel, the unused nuclear fuel, on the top as spheres, and then the spheres would like fall down, and on the bottom you remove the spheres, and the spheres drop right into the storage container to have a much more simple refueling process, which was envisioned to make these reactors much more economical and much more reliable, since the simplified refueling process, as they envisioned, would also increase downtime when refueling and allow for online refueling. But these bubblegum type reactors, as we tried here in Germany, as X-Energy wants to try, as the Chinese have built 2 reactors, which they are currently operating, though they are not operating them quite as well as they hope to. So these TRISO-fueled reactors also have a problem with these spherical fuel elements. You don't have like a very clearly defined flow for your gas through the reactor. Inside with like what the AGR or the prismatically fueled TRISO reactors, since you have traditional fuel elements, which are always at the same place, you always know where your fuel is, where your coolant is flowing in very straight, very direct and controllable lines. This is not the case inside your pebble bed reactor. You have a chaotic sea of spheres, and the coolant tries to move around there. Also, in these pebble beds, the coolant also, the spheres also rub against each other as they fall down and as it transfers through the reactor. Also, when you want to insert control rods inside the reactor, this becomes an issue. These pebbles are not like water. If you ram a control rod in there, you get a lot of friction. And this became a huge problem at the bigger one of the German pebble bed reactors. This control rod broke the fuel elements. Also, the fuel elements broke as they rubbed against each other and transferred through the down to the reactor. So this reactor had a large amount of fuel element failures and a large amount of radioactivity release coming from this design of reactor and this design of fuel element. One has to mention that the fuel design, the fuels used in the fuel in the German reactors, is certainly of a lesser quality than the TRISO fuel. The TRISO, so TRISO stands for tri-structural fuel. So the essential fuel pellet inside is coated 3 times by a ceramic, and in the German one they had to coat it just 2 times. So you can say that the fuel that X-Energy is going to use in the reactor certainly of a much more better quality than what the German reactor used in the 80. And also, since they use a smaller reactor in power output, they use a somewhat different design than the big reactor that we had here in Germany. They use a design where they have, rather than control rods, which ram directly into the fuel elements, they have control rods at the outside of the reactor vessel, which they can turn, and just they can control how much neutrons escape the reactor vessel, and therefore can control the reaction from the outside. This way of reactor control is much less damaging to the fuel, but it has also drawbacks. It is much less powerful. Its control authority over the nuclear reaction is much smaller, and reactors larger than a certain size can no longer be controlled by this type of control rods. In the small trisofuel pebble bed reactor, which we had here in Germany in the 60s, the AVR, they also used the external control rod, which would not be inside the vessel but outside of it. This reactor had not enough control authority with the external control rods over its reactor. They struggled to shut the reactor down on several occasions where the control rods did not have enough authority to properly throttle down the reactor. So the design with the control rods at the outside has the problem that it can generate much, much less power than the one with the control rods ramming inside the vessel. And also, it might not have enough control authority at all. This has been a problem at the German reactors, whether its energy has addressed this issue. I cannot say. There's not enough for me to know about their design. But this has been a problem that its energy certainly needs to overcome. And it limits their reactor to a certain size. The German reactor was 17 megawatts electric, and it still had the problems that it had not enough control authority. I do wonder whether the 100 megawatt can do this, and when they want to go above the 100 megawatts, they will either need prismatic fuel, or they need to have the design where the control rods move inside the sea of pebbles. And hopefully this time the pebbles won't break.
So this is probably quite simplistic analysis, but in terms of assessing the commercial and operational maturity of a technology, it does seem useful to look at sort of the number of reactor years of operation. And I think our light water and pressurized heavy water fleets are up in the 17,000 reactor years of operation. And that's meant that we've worked through a lot of kinks. We've identified a lot of problems. We've innovated based upon operational experience and gotten to the exceptional capacity factors we now have, which are part of what makes economical nuclear economical. In terms of getting a sense of these other technologies, and I think for today's show, I think we should just focus on gas reactors, just for the limit of time that we have, the hard stop I have. What's the number of sort of reactors of operational experience we have? I think molten salt reactors is about 3. It's all in national labs. And sodium fast reactors run to several hundreds. What about the gas reactor technologies? The advanced gas reactors in the UK are going to give us a lot, but these pebble bed reactors or the bubblegum machine reactors?
Well, with the British reactors, we're probably talking around like 600, 700 reactor years of operation. Though one might argue that with the large downtime that this reactor had, where one could actually count a reactor year, the same way you count light water reactor year. With the pebble bed reactor, it is much worse. And Dragon reactor in Britain, which was never a power plant, just a demonstration reactor, only gives you a couple of years. The AVR in Germany only gives you a couple of years. The American one, which wasn't even one of the pebble bed reactor, well, it used trisofuel but didn't have the pebble beds, only have a couple of years. And the really big German one, the THDR, didn't get 2 years. It was built in 13 years. No German nuclear reactor was ever this expensive in relation to its power and took this long to build. And after all this long build time, the reactor ran terribly. It basically needed to go offline every 3 days and had like 20% capacity factor over the time. It ran for a good 500 days and then it was shut down because the project partners, which funded it, saw the design failing and then they dropped out and then the program had to be shut down. So from the THTR, you only get like 500 operational days probably. And what these operational days give you, they indicate a lot of problems. They don't give a lot of practical experience. It's more like you ran it for 500 days, all of which were miserable, all of which show you the problems, but don't really show you the solutions to the problems. And after the THTR in Germany shut down in 89, after that, we never had another one until the Chinese opened theirs a year ago. And from these two, we now have two more operational years. And hopefully these two will provide a significant amount of operational years. But when we talk about total operational years of the TRISO high-temperature reactor, we are barely in the double digits.
So this leads me to propose a new definition of advanced nuclear. Advanced nuclear is the nuclear that advanced. The kind of nuclear that survived, that proved itself operational and commercial, and that is essentially the nuclear that we have with us today. And then we have non-advanced nuclear, which is nuclear that has yet to advance, that has only made it, you know, a few, you know, single-digit, double-digit reactor years of operation. Because I just see this incredible hubris and the kind of promotional materials, they look amazing, right? And to a policymaker who has not got the kind of in-depth background knowledge that you have or that many of my other guests have, they see a promotional PowerPoint. Looks great. This looks brand spanking new, shiny. Okay, it's going to deliver on X, Y, and Z promise. But I think what policymakers are lacking is, you know, the history. And that was why it was amazing to have Nick Turan on the other day to give us some context. You know, many, many concepts have been tried from the 50s onwards, and the advanced ones advanced, and those that did not advance did not. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't develop those technologies more, but I think it does probably suggest that there needs to be a lot less hubris in terms of just saying, you know, this is going to be commercially mature. We're going to have, you know, X energy reactors distilling petrochemicals, Dow chemical in, you know, 5-10 years and doing so, you know, commercially and economically. Diatribe over, but I think you get my point.
So can I first just say, I would think it would be really funny if in all your future appearances and nowadays you get invited to a lot of them, refer to these reactors as the yet to advance reactors rather than the advanced reactors. I think this is gotcha. A nice thing, just like with like with the SMRs. I am quite sympathetic to the people with the hubris. I am, unlike you, I'm not a pessimist. I'm actually an optimist, but I don't know. I cannot have my hope. I don't have enough cognitive dissonance that I can like keep my optimism whenever people point out the flaws for that I have in my reason for my optimism. So other than other people who need to have the cognitive dissonance. I'm sorry, I worked a lot today. Other than the people who have a lot of cognitive dissonance, I cannot just stand with what my views were. I need to reframe them and I need to change them because I don't like it how I feel when I'm not an optimist. So whenever my optimistic vision gets challenged, I get much more motivated to find out like another way. So every time it was pointed out to me that my reasons for an optimism were flawed, I adjusted it and found a better way. So when it was pointed out to me that my reason to be optimistic about renewables was flawed, I changed there. And when I realized that my reason to be optimistic about the yet-to-advance reactors was flawed, I needed to change my outlook from there. I'm not a pessimist. I am quite optimistic that with the reactors that we have, which are actually mature, first and foremost pressurized and boiling water reactors, and second sodium cooled reactors, I'm very confident and very optimistic that we can completely decarbonize with these. And this is the foundation of my optimism. And I am therefore critical of people who just who are as gung-ho on the yet to advance reactors, because I don't want to be gloomy. I want to have a well-founded optimism so I can sleep well at night. And if I would need to put my hope on something where I'm not certain enough that it can actually work, that would not make me sleep well at night. So I need to have my optimism grounded in reality. But I'm sympathetic to people who strive for a lot of things and who say, like, my conservative optimism is not good enough for them. They want more, and I cheer on them. And I really hope that its energy achieves what it set out to achieve. Proof that maybe the German engineers, which did the high temperature gas reactors in the 80s, were not maybe the best quality of engineers. And personally, what I have found out, the nuclear engineers in Germany, which went into high temperature reactors, were not made from the same wood as the nuclear reactor engineers that went into the light water reactors. They were not as competent and nice people. Maybe the its energy people are much more competent and they can use much more modern tools to fulfill their vision. I still think that operational experience, both in cumulative reactor years and in how many reactor years the oldest reactor has put on his stomach, I think this is really important if you have a proper and well-researched mature design. And this cannot, this operational experience cannot be replaced by having better CAM and CAD software and having better milling machines and forges than we had in the 80s and better material sciences with the fuel. There needs to be the operational experience for a mature design. I really hope X-Energy proves me wrong. If X-Energy sets out what it achieves, I can sleep very well at night. I would be very happy about that. I would gladly buy nuclear synthetic fuels from them and put them in my car and have fun driving over the Hessian countryside. But I do not expect that, and I don't want to base my optimism, my positive outlook on these dreams that X-Energy have, and therefore I don't want that our energy policy is based on these. I want our energy policy based on reliable, mature technology so that we can be certain that we can sustainably for the long term have a supply of energy that is plentiful enough, that is secure enough, and that's cheap enough, that I can sleep well for my future and for the future of the children that I plan on having in the future. So I cheer for its energy when they have success. I will really do that. But when they go around and promoting their reactor as the solution to all of our energy problems, which will lead to less resources and capital and political goodwill being allocated to pressurized and sodium pressurized water, boiling water, and sodium cooled reactors, which definitely can solve our energy problems, I do not like that. Sorry.
So we're going to have to leave it here in the next couple of minutes. So I'm going to kind of take the mic and do one last reflection here. I've been reading a fair amount about nuclear history recently, mostly on the Canadian side, and it's just leading me to realize that we had this unique moment of scientific and technical mobilization in the form of the Manhattan Project and what I'll call the Manhattan Project North. The original Canadian nuclear research facilities were very much pursuing the same goals as the nuclear research south of the border, which was weapons technology. This led to massive wartime spending. And an incredible accumulation of human and institutional capacity. And when the war was over, and particularly Canada was not interested in being nuclear armed We devoted those resources towards research and engineering to develop this lineage of the pressurized heavy water reactor. And we iterated. We went through three or four different research reactor designs, culminating in the National Power Demonstration Reactor, a 20 megawatt CANDU precursor. Then we went to 200 megawatts at Douglas Point, 500 megawatts at Pickering, 800 at Bruce, 900 at Darlington. Now we're hopefully heading for a gigawatt. But iteratively, we've run into all kinds of problems. We've troubleshot them. But at the nucleus of that is an incredible investment. And I hope it's not a one-time investment, but you can see sort of why it was. Hearing stats around the Manhattan Project consuming like 6 or 7% of U.S. electricity, this gives you a sense just of one element of the resources poured into this project, which had that spillover effect of leading to the design moving through the valley of death on certain reactor technologies and the ones that advanced. So I just want to give that context. And I think for a lot of these other concepts to advance, I'm a little pessimistic because I think that they need a similar mobilization of scientific resources, and I'm not sure that we have that at the present moment. I am not even going to let you respond to that. We're going to leave that as a pregnant pause. We're going to have you just be for interest of time. Hard stop. I've got to go talk about Pickering on national media. But I do want to have you back because we didn't pull on that sodium cooled reactor thread, and I'd like to finish this excellent conversation about process heat. You know, I've even heard people say that a reason to be pro-fusion is because we could use process heat from fusion. I'm very interested to hear your perspective on that, but I'm not going to let you share it right now. Noel Retberg, great to have you back on the podcast. I'm sure this is going to earn you some lovers and haters, but thank you for doing what you do and being able to offer a perspective. I think because you don't work in the industry, you're able to say a lot. Maybe because there is no German industry anymore, you're able to be very free with your thoughts. And that's what we love on Decouple is people that can come and offer opinions freely.
That's a nice way of saying I have questionable qualifications.
All right. Well, we'll let the audience judge, Noah. Awesome to have you back, and we will talk again soon.
Bye.